And today is Monday, February 6th, 2017, and I am opening the first meeting of the Joint Ways and Means Committee on General Government.
There's
like the airplane. If you're not going to Denver, please get off the airplane.
Okay, let me start that all over again. That's a great start. Let that be a lesson to me. Human Services, Joint Committee on Human Services, Force of Habit, 4 years of chairing one subcommittee. Before we get any further, I'd love to have my colleagues introduce themselves. So we'll just start at that end and go from there. Representative Malmstrom.
Okay, I'm Representative Sherry Malmstrom, and I represent House District 27, Southwest Portland and Beaverton.
And it's fine if you want to say two lines about your background. I mean,
okay.
It's relevant, anybody who wants to, and why you're interested to be on the subcommittee or whatever.
Oh, okay. Well, my background is I've spent over 30 years being a public health nurse for Multnomah County Health Department, and I've been on the Women's Commission, and I have a real strong interest in healthcare issues, human service issues. That's what public health nurses do, so I'm very excited to be on this committee.
Great. Representative Alonso León.
Thank you. Good morning. Buenos dias. My name is Representative Teresa Alonso León, and I represent District 22, which is Woodburn through the north part of Salem. And my passion is education. My background is actually a nonprofit work, education, and social justice areas. And I'm super excited to be part of this committee. I have a lot to learn, and I feel like we have a great team. Thank you.
Great. Thanks, Representative Hayden.
Good morning. Thank you. Pleasure to join this committee this time around. I'm Representative Cedric Hayden. Represent House District 7, which is basically Eugene to Roseburg along the I-5 corridor, east and west of that. It's a little more defined than that, but that gets the geographical area. I serve currently on the House Healthcare as Vice Chair, so this committee will be kind of tying in with that as a good place. My background professionally is I'm a dentist, part-time dentist at this point. My practice is limited to hospital-based dentistry, where I do mostly adults, special needs, and children.
Great. Thank you. My good co-chair.
Yeah. Dan Rayfield, State Representative, Corvallis, Philomath. You know, background attorney. The reason I guess I want to serve on this committee is during the last couple of sessions, I have had zero meetings with Alan Treseder. Doesn't book anything with our office. And I said, what's the best way to be in a committee where I can have a little contact with Mr. Treseder?
And nicely done, Representative. Yeah. Very nicely done.
Senator Winters.
It'll take too long. I'm Senator Winters. I represent District 10, which is parts of South Salem, Southeast Salem, West Salem, Monmouth, Independence, Almsville, and Turner, and I've been involved somehow in human services since 1969.
Which is why we all turn to her for her historical knowledge and expertise. Senator Gelser.
So my name is Sarah Gelser, and I represent Corvallis, Philomath, so part of, all of Dan's district, and then also Albany, Millersburg, Tangent, up to the edge of Lebanon. I chair the Human Services Committee and serve on the Education Committee and the Workforce Committee, and on the Committee on Conduct, which I think we hope doesn't ever meet.
We do hope.
Oh, we do? Okay. Very good.
And depends upon if everybody behaves.
Yes, so we should all behave, because that's a lot of committees. So I'm really looking forward to serve on the committee. I have a background, especially in disability. I worked for the Department of Human Services for a time focused on in-home supports for people with disabilities and served for a while on the National Council on Disability.
Great. And I'm Elizabeth Steiner-Hayward, State Senator from Northwest Portland and Beaverton, family physician by training. I've been on this committee. This is my sixth year now. Benefited a lot from Senator Winters and her expertise, and I'm excited to co-chair this year. Representative Buehler,
good
just
morning.
In the nick of time.
Good morning.
I want to introduce yourself to the team, please.
Sure.
Thanks.
I'm Newt Buehler. I represent House District 54, which is most of the city of Bend.
And we're taking the liberty to say a couple things about ourselves so people know why we're on the sub or whatever.
Well, I had a snowy drive over from Ben this morning.
I bet you did.
That's one of the
I bet you did.
Yeah. I've represented House District 54 for now the second term. My day job is orthopedic surgeon. I've practiced and lived in Ben for nearly 20 years.
Great. Today and tomorrow, because are going to be primarily orientation, and mostly that will be in the hands of our good colleagues, Linda Ames and Lori Byerly. And I'd like you guys to start by introducing yourselves, and then we're going to run through a few things about committee practice. But these two people are going to be your best friends this year, and get to know them and take advantage of their expertise and their kind nature, because they will help you learn what you need to learn. So, Linda.
Linda Ames, I'm the Legislative Fiscal Office Analyst for the Oregon Health Authority and the Psychiatric Security Review Board.
And I'm Lori Byerly. I'm the Legislative Fiscal Office Analyst for the Department of Human Services, and I also work with the Long-Term Care Ombudsman Budget.
So between the two of us, we will be here like 95% of the days that we're in this committee.
Right. In other subcommittees, if you've been on them, you will know that you see a main scheduler, but then you see a large rotating crew of analysts. Not so much in this sub. You will become very good friends with Ms. Ames and Ms. Byerly, which is a good thing. I want to start, if I could, just by, we need to adopt rules first or go over?
We don't adopt rules.
We don't adopt rules because they went by the other thing. Okay. There's all, you know, there's little things in every committee. So let me start with the hard part. We will start promptly. Today we did not because it's the first day, but we will start promptly at 8:30 every single day. However, to do that, we need a quorum, which means two of us on this side of the dais and three of you on that side of the dais. We cannot start even an informational hearing, apparently, in Ways and Means without a quorum. Now, it doesn't mean that we have to keep one every single second. If somebody has to step out, that's okay. But we will need one, obviously, to vote on things. So that's the important thing. So we need people to be here. The other thing is that since we have lots of new folks, and this is complicated stuff, and we are facing an enormous set of challenges in the subcommittee, it will be really helpful if you can hear everything. So we understand if people have to step out, if you have to not be here, but we're just going to encourage you to try hard to be here as much as possible. This is the first time that Representative Rayfield and I have co-chaired this committee, either of us, and we're very, very eager to have all of you participate as much as possible. I know Representative Rayfield has met with many, if not all, of the folks on the House side. I've had conversations informally with both Senator Winters and Senator Gelser, and we're very eager to know how you want to be engaged. So feel free to reach out to us, ask us questions, tell us how we can be helpful to us, to you, and we can work together. As I said before, Ms. Ames and Ms. Byerly are your new best friends. Mr. Sorensen, I forgot to ask you to introduce yourself. Could you introduce yourself just briefly? Say hello. I apologize.
I'm Eric Sorensen, the assistant for this committee.
And Eric's great. I've worked with him for years, and we're lucky to have him on our team this year. Please make sure that by the end of the day today, if Representative Rayfield, Ms. Ames, Ms. Byerly, and I do not already have your cell phone numbers, that we do, because we want to be able to be in touch with you. I think I've got most of yours, maybe not Representative Hayden's. We promise not to pester you too much, but we just need to be able to reach you in case of an emergency. We know that this is a lot of material to absorb really fast, and we are all of the opinion that we want folks to ask lots of questions. That being said, there will be times when it may be better to take a conversation offline, just because there's an area you really want to dig into a little bit more deeply. LFO can also be super helpful in working with you and the agencies to get answers to questions that maybe other people in the committee will be interested in. So oftentimes we'll ask questions at a hearing, and we'll ask the witnesses to submit those to Ms. Ames or Ms. Byerly, whoever's running that meeting, and then those will be distributed out to the committee members, and we may discuss them at the next meeting. The other point that I would make is technically we are scheduled to go till 9:45. The reality is that an hour and 15 minutes when the
Ways and Means subs are usually an hour and a half, is really not enough time. And so we plan to go to 9:55 every day. Please do not, if at all possible, schedule appointments for 9:45. We know everybody, I think, has caucus at 10, so we'll make sure you're out in time for caucus. But we hope everybody will plan to stay till 9:55 every day. If you think you're going to be out for some reason, please give us as much notice as possible. Again, we know that emergencies happen, and we get that. Most of us have families with kids at home, and or many of us do, and other things that come up. So please just let us know if there's an issue. But when you do, if you'd email Ms. Byerly, Ms. Ames, and Representative Rayfield and myself, that would be super helpful, so we're all on the same page. And last but not least, if you think you're going to have a problem with a vote, please let us know as soon as possible. Please be aware of what's coming up for possible work sessions, because we need to know how we want to plan for it if there's going to be an issue. Everybody absolutely has the right to vote his or her conscience on stuff, and we don't want to take away that right. We just want to be prepared. Surprises don't help us. Representative Hayden.
Define problem with a vote. Does that mean if we're going to vote against something, or is that...
However you want to define it. Certainly if you're going to vote against it, it's helpful for us to know. I'm not going to try to talk you out of it necessarily, yeah. But I think we would both really like to know any concerns you have with a vote that's coming up, because oftentimes those can be resolved if we know about them ahead of time. We can address concerns, we can make amendments, we can do stuff. For those of you, which I think is 5 out of the 8 of us, who haven't been on Ways and Means before, you will hear it said that we do not do policy in Ways and Means, and that is generally true. However, because of the structure that we have in the legislature, if there are policy bills that come our direction, only one chamber will have seen them. Only one chamber's policy committee will have seen it, and it will not be going to the policy committee on the other side. So a Senate bill that comes to this committee, the only chance the House members have to comment on it and potentially work with their caucuses to adjust it is here in Ways and Means. And the same thing's true for House bills. That's the only time the Senate will see it. So there are plenty of times when we do end up having to do policy, as it were, in here. So that's why knowing about issues ahead of time is helpful, because then we can see if we can adjust them to everybody's satisfaction, because that is possible. Senator Winters, I would love to offer you the opportunity to add anything else based on your long experience on this committee.
There's not a lot that I can add. Part of it you'll learn as you go along. Just a couple things to remember. Unlike your policy committees, Ways and Means, which is budget, the job here actually is to help balance the budget. As the good senator said, you've got two very learned, capable legislative fiscal officers, and you will meet some of the others. They will do a lot of the work. If you have questions, I would encourage you to talk to them. The other thing is that please don't assume anything. That's a very thing that you should not do. She briefly touched on the importance of to be here. When you're not here, and let's say that I'm not here and we don't have a quorum on this side or on that side, you can't conduct business. The other thing is that, where on the issue of vote, if there is a situation that there is not enough votes to pass something, the chair can call one of the co-chairs to come in to break either a tie or to sit in your place, or you can get one presiding officer. Your work will be extremely supportive, important. You have in this committee probably one of the most difficult budgets that is in this building. Everyone likes to be on education. Education, to me, is very straightforward. That is not true when you're dealing with the complication that exists in human services. So just to know, I would encourage all of you to do your homework to don't think that we're just talking foster care or whatever. You've got the most complicated budget that I believe, and I've been around here a long time, that exists. You know, you only have the three major that's coming out of general fund. That is human services, education, and public safety. And yours is the most difficult.
Sure. Thank you so much. Representative Rayfield, if it's okay with you, I was going to say, do you want to talk now or do you want to talk tomorrow when you're chairing? Your choice.
The only thing I would just kind of add on and just kind of as far as looking at scheduling, and we mentioned that to open an informational hearing, we have to have a quorum. From time to time, we're going to have grants in the early part of this process where we will have to take votes on those. And so if we go to 9:55, so if you have to leave early or if for some reason letting us know, that's kind of that importance of
great
why
point.
Letting us know early. So that way we could take a, you know, hold a public hearing, move to the grant, pass it on to keep business flowing and is a part of the committee workload. So just being aware that there are some things that we're going to have to work on. Those are the things I was going to add in.
Thank you. Okay. Then, Ms. Ames, the meeting is yours.
Okay. Madam Chair, members of the subcommittee, the good news is they just covered a whole bunch of this material in the first part of our orientation, which is kind of how the committee works and process. So there will be a few more things I'll go over. It's on OLIS, but we weren't going to project this part. It's too many words. After we finish this part, Lori, I'll start in with kind of a budget 101 that will give us some context for how budget works, statewide perspective on budget, and then at the end, some perspective on context in the human services budget. And it's 2 days, so don't be alarmed when you see 47 pages out there. The rules are in the packet if you want to take a look at them. The primary thing is the quorum. We need 3 people on the House and 2 people on the Senate. And as the chair mentioned, to open a meeting and then to vote on anything. And the full committee chairs can come down if they need to. Remember cell phones, the usual. The microphones are very sensitive. They will pick up when you talk, whether you mean for them or not. Mostly we will be somewhat informal here and go on voice votes, but there will be roll call by the committee assistant if we need to. This is an all-electronic committee. Things will be posted on OLIS, hopefully several days ahead of time so that you can have a chance to review them. You're welcome to follow along on your laptops here or print out the materials ahead. Our only exception to that is there will be a paper agenda so that you have something to write on if you need to. Meeting notice is required to be 72 hours for the first public hearing of a bill and then 48 hours for either a public hearing or a work session after that. Typically near the end of session, those times get lesser and lesser. Bills can be carried over to the next day only under certain circumstances. And on page 6 and 7 in your packet, you will see the draft weekly agendas for the next couple of weeks. I'll normally, towards the end of each week, send you the agenda for the next week so that you have a sense of what's coming. The list of all the budget bills that we will be hearing in here, as well as the LFO and the Chief Financial Office staff, is on page 8. The Chief Financial Office is a group of analysts, much like the legislative fiscal analysts, but that work on the executive branch side and help the governor to put that budget together. Besides, there's 5 budgets in the human services program area, what we call the Oregon Health Authority and DHS are the 2 monster budgets, and then there's 3 small budgets, Psych Security Review Board, Long-Term Care Ombudsman, and the Blind Commission. And in addition, there are 2 other budgets that will be heard in this subcommittee because they have a lot of linkages, the Medical Board and the Board of Nursing. Those 2 budgets don't have general funds, so sometimes, depending on how the committee goes along, that we may be taking action on those budgets sooner than we would a general fund budget. Besides budgets, the subcommittee will hear budget-related fee bills. The Oregon Health Authority does have a fee ratification bill this time to ratify bills that were either increased or established during the interim. federal grants, which have been mentioned, which do take a vote and need to be moved to the full committee. Reports, both formal and informal. Sometimes we bring formal reports as a result of a requirement in a budget note, and then we do take action on those and pass them to the full committee. Other times it'll just be part of an agency presentation. Come probably early May, there will be a bill to do the final rebalance for the DHS and OHA budgets. We did leave them in the last emergency board with small budget holes, and they may end up needing more resources. By the time we do that rebalance, we will have a new caseload forecast for both agencies, and that will, to a large extent, determine what issues they may have. And finally, policy bills that will come typically later in the biennium, and they'll be assigned by the co-chairs to various subcommittees. So the first couple months, we'll be doing what we're calling phase one, which is legislative fiscal will introduce the agency, give some context for budgets and issues, and then the agency will describe what they do, major issues, have they been doing, how have they been doing, outcomes. And then at the end, the chief financial office will present a high-level summary of a governor's budget. There will be an opportunity for public testimony for each budget bill. For the little budgets, that will typically be the same day that the agency presents. For OHA and DHS, we typically have several days that are just public testimony because they tend to be quite popular. Phase two hearings then will start in April. That may not affect all agencies. Basically, at that point, we're trying to get additional information on issues that have come up along the way that we think we need in order to make those final budget decisions. And phase three are the final work sessions. For OHA and DHS, those work sessions are usually relatively late in sessions, but sometimes small other fund agencies will be decided as early as March. It varies. You have a number of resources available to you to learn more about the agencies. On the first day that each agency meets, we will post on OLIS the governor's budget document, which is typically quite a large document. It has some narrative about all the different programs, issues, org charts. It'll have the reduction options, and then a whole bunch of technical printouts from the budget system. You can go and see which program spends how much on travel, all the details there for you to look at. A little bit more manageable of a document. The bigger agencies do a ways and means kind of a reference document that includes all the things we've asked them to provide for presentations. They will also be doing presentations each day in here, but there's just a lot more detail in this document. And finally, LFO has done what we're calling budget review documents for each agency. They're typically 2 or 3 page summaries that try to go right to the heart of what are the major budget issues. And they're a kind of nice short document you can use to get some context for where issues might be coming up. I've put links to a few other documents. The LFO analysis of the 15-17 legislatively adopted budget is a really good resource we do at the end of each session that gives a lot more detail about how programs work and budget issues, as well as what was in that specific budget. And there's an update to that for what happened in the 2016 session. And finally, there's the link for the co-chair's budget. The last three bullets are really about process, and we're going to hit that again in the PowerPoint that we'll start here. So between it, maybe we'll get clarification. There'll be some actual examples of some of the work products, for instance. So we'll have work sessions not only to make decisions on the budget, but also the committee does formally approve the key performance measures and the targets for this biennium. Staff provides a memo and some work session papers to go through and take all the specific actions. We'll prepare amendments to the budget bill that is consistent with our recommendation at committee. Then we prepare a budget report that goes to the full and then to the chambers as a document that explains what all the decisions were that were made for that agency. Budget notes can be included in the budget report if they're essential to clarify or expand on an administrative requirement directly related to the budget. Those should go through the co-chairs here, the subcommittee co-chairs, and they must be approved by both of the co-chairs of the full committee. I think generally we remind members that they are not a substitute for the bill that you didn't get passed. They're not to do legislative issues, and they do not have the force of law, but it is a way to get the agency back in for a report or for some additional discussion, some additional information, that sort of thing. The chairs here will assign members to carry items to the full and to the chambers. I do remind you, carriers to the full committee must be members of the full committee, and five of us here are not. So if we try to assign something to one of you, just go, no, not me. Staff will prepare a summary. We call it a pony.
How many do we have? It's not.
it's you, Rayfield, and me.
Yeah.
Are the only ones on full.
So you'll be busy.
Of the entire committee?
Yeah.
Of the entire committee.
Wow.
There's only three.
But that does not mean someone can carry it on the floor.
Right.
So.
Yes.
We share the punishment.
Yeah.
So staff prepares a pony that you can read at full or on the chamber. Many members like to be more creative about what they say on the chamber, so they don't necessarily pay much attention to the pony, especially in the policy bills. And staff will always be at the side aisle on the chamber in case that you need more information as a result of the discussion. We're always happy to sit with you on the floor if you want that support, even though we can't actually talk. We can only whisper to you. The rest of this document, then, the PowerPoint that Lori's going to run, is really about the state budget and processes, how the budget works, what LFO does, and then finally there'll be some materials that will come tomorrow about the human services budget. Can you make it come up? Eric really is the most important member here. Not only does he make these things appear, but he makes sure the microphones are turned off at the end.
So the next few slides are actually a standardized presentation that the Legislative Fiscal Officer Ken Rocco uses frequently when briefing members and people outside our office. So they're kind of like high level, here's how we kind of do budget in Oregon, and here's what our office does. So just to kind of start at the beginning, so the one thing that the legislature has to do every 2 years is pass a balanced budget. And that's not explicitly in one part of the Constitution, but there are three different sections of the Constitution that sort of drive toward that requirement, and they're listed on this slide. So that's just for your information. And as far as the office itself, we are a budget office. We're not really a physical office. We're located in the building on the first floor in the House wing. That's where you can find us. Budget policy in Oregon is balancing based on estimated revenues and proposed expenditures. So this committee will focus on the estimates around proposed expenditures. The revenue and finance committees focus on sort of the revenue forecast at the big picture level for general fund and some other statewide resources. The committees and the budget process focus on achieving desired outcomes. As Linda mentioned, there is a key performance measure system, and you'll hear about those performance measures from agencies that come to the budget process, and we're trying to drive towards some results and outcomes based on those measures. And encouraging savings and investments to reduce or avoid future costs. That's something we're probably going to be talking about a lot this session. As far as the budget itself, am I staticky?
No, you're fine.
It's echoing in my ear. You know,
and the other thing I would say is, as we're going through this, I think what we talked about is wanting to have this be a conversation. So if you have questions, just put it out there and say, hey, what the heck did you just say? You know, how does that apply to me? Whatever questions you guys may have.
I appreciate that.
Yeah.
And I guess we should say, by the way, that it's just like any other committee. Whichever of us, and Representative Rayfield and I will be alternating. I'll be chairing Mondays and Wednesdays. He'll be chairing Tuesdays and Thursdays. It's just like any other committee. You want to ask a question, just wave. And if you're not getting my or his attention, poke the person next to you and get them to poke the person next to them. And eventually somebody will see. It's just a standard committee structure in that regard.
For those of you who like looking into the law, the state budget policy is laid out in statute. It's in ORS 291 with some other administrative requirements. So if that's something you want to take a look at sometime, that is where you can find it in the statute. And while you'll hear a lot of conversation around planning for the long term, just for technical purposes, the budget that's being balanced is only on a two-year period. So you may hear a lot about a 10-year plan or sort of what the future looks like, but as far as what has to be balanced, it's really the two-year biennium that is before you, and that will be this 2017-19 biennium that we'll be working toward balancing. As far as our office, its mission is to promote state fiscal accountability, and under that, we try to do that by providing objective research, analysis, and evaluation of state expenditures, revenues, and administration. On the revenue side, our office will focus on revenues that are specific to an agency's budget plan, for example, fee revenues and other revenues that are not really statewide revenues that the agency will be using to help balance our budget. The office is nonpartisan. We do have permanent staff, so we're here all the time. We do have some session staff that come on to help during the long session, but we are around. We work all year round, not just during session. And while the work is primarily directed by the Joint Committee on Ways and Means, we also work with all legislators and committees. So,
Ms. Byerly, Representative Buehler.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Just a quick question. So who tracks key performance metrics and if they've been fulfilled?
Madam Co-Chair, Representative Buehler, there's a key performance measure management system that's a statewide system that is maintained at the state level. Agencies input information into that system. Reports are produced and published on the transparency website. And then during the legislative process, you will look at the list of measures for that agency and evaluate those and make a determination on targets or direction where they should be going. No longer in existence is the Oregon Progress Board. Used to be a body that actually oversaw that process, but that board no longer exists, so the effort to manage those is really down at the agency and legislative fiscal office kind of management level.
So those are self-reporting by the agency?
Madam Co-Chair, Representative Buehler, to the extent which agencies have their own data reporting those measures, yes, but some of the measures we can actually validate outside the agency based on their statistics and metrics we're using that aren't directly within the agency.
Okay. Thank you.
If I could add just one other point about that, it is one of the areas where I think Ways and Means subcommittees can be very helpful. We require agencies to look hard at their KPMs as part of their process of getting ready for the presentations and to bring forward any recommendations about changes that they would request. That being said, the agencies have a lot on their plates, and it's a place where I personally think I've seen Ways and Means subcommittees be useful. So I personally would encourage you to look at the KPMs carefully and think about whether they're really the kinds of end outcomes that we want to be measuring. Mm-hmm. Or are they intermediate outcomes that aren't perhaps quite as useful? So, in the medical world, we would say it's great if it lowers blood sugar, but does it actually reduce the risk of eye damage from diabetes, right? Or it's great if it lowers cholesterol, but does it reduce the risk of heart attacks, actually reduce that? So are we looking at lowering cholesterol, or are we looking at reducing heart attacks? And I would just encourage you to be thinking about those as well, because we want to be sure that we're using the best evidence to fund things.
And you can find the complete report from last year for each agency in that governor's binder or in the Ways and Means reference material. And the agencies will be bringing that forward but sometimes because there's so many of them and it's part of a broader discussion, it may not be all the detail. In those reports, you can see the history of their what it's looked like over time and quite a lot of narrative, their analysis of what's working, what isn't, and that sort of thing.
You'll also hear agencies talk about, since these key performance measures were really came out of a system that was really statewide outcome focused, they're pretty big measures. Agencies, especially larger ones, will have a lot of metrics and measurements below those that they use to really manage their daily business. So you may hear them talk a lot about internal metrics they're using really to manage the operations, where some of the KPMs are really pretty high level and don't maybe have a lot of meaning for someone working in the field or directly with clients on the ground. So you'll hear about some of that too.
And I guess the one other thing I would add is that over the past 4 years, we've been transitioning pretty much across all agencies to, at least certain of the bigger ones, to new systems where we break things down in a different way. And what's that term? What's that form that we're using now that has all the different headings and then the who's responsible and it's got the KPMs in it? You know what I'm talking about. I'll pull one up. Never mind. Keep going. Sorry. I'll go back to last year and find one. Sorry.
And just for history, the office was first created in 1959 as part of the legislation and government reform effort that created the emergency board. As far as an organizational chart, we have 22 positions. They're all budgeted as full-time. Again, we do work when the legislature's not in session. We have a biannual budget of about $8 million. There are two managers in the office. That's the fiscal officer, Ken Rocco, and the deputy fiscal officer, who's now Paul Siebert. We have a committee office of manager that manages the session staff and other folks in the office. We have an administrative support position that provides assistance at the front desk if you come into our office. We have 18 budget analysts with varying responsibilities. As Linda and I mentioned, we are responsible for certain agencies, and that's how the office work is structured. Analysts are assigned to certain program areas and certain budgets at the agency level that they manage. Eight of our analysts have program area coordinators responsibilities. So we're coordinating the human services program area here. We have analysts that work with the other program areas as well. We have staff that are responsible for issuing the fiscal impact statement. So the work that you see in the policy committee, the fiscal impact statements that get issued to go along with bills are also completed by our office. Budget analysts do have a review component of that work, but we have got fiscal analysts that are primarily responsible for that. Let's see. And you may hear that some states have a different organization. So in Oregon, we have a Joint Ways and Means Committee. We have one fiscal office that supports that operation. In some other states, there may be as many as four offices of a similar type that support different caucuses or chambers. So again, different states have varying structures, and especially as you work with your NCSL colleagues or other folks, you may hear about different models. But that's kind of our Oregon model. Some agencies also are very large. They may have a couple hundred staff working for them. We're kind of small, but I think we try to get the necessary work done. And sometimes you may hear about efforts at coordination between our office and maybe the policy office in terms of trying to bring information together for the committee to help in the decision-making process. So during session, you'll hear, as Linda went through, you're going to hear about agency budgets. We review those budgets for accuracy. We check numbers. We try to primary source information. We review revenues. We try to make sure the answers are being consistent, that the story hasn't changed. Sometimes we'll find that over time things kind of morph and something that was described one way a couple years ago may be different now. So we try to validate that for you and help explain things that may seem inconsistent. We examine revenue sources. We look at the impact of budget reductions or enhancements. As Linda mentioned, in some of the documents you'll see posted on OLIS, we'll have reduction lists. We expect that's going to be a strong focus of this committee in light of the co-chair budget. There's going to have to be some work around trying to reduce costs and make budgets smaller in this program area. Make recommendations to you on those budgets, respond to questions. So outside of the work that goes on in the subcommittee, we do get questions from members and from the public on the statewide budget. We try to provide responses to those. We assist you on the floors when you carry bills. So typically the Joint Ways and Means Committee has seven subcommittees. This is one of those. So there's an education subcommittee, general government, natural resources, public safety, transportation, economic development, and then a capital construction subcommittee. Am I sounding hoarse? Our office also supports an information technology committee and an audits committee, but those are not subcommittees of the Joint Ways and Means Committee, but we do work with those committees as well. During session, the full committee usually meets once a week. That later on in session, that will accelerate as more material, more information comes out of subcommittees, more bills get passed to full, and there's more action to be taken. I think those are all my notes on committees. Interim responsibilities. So during the interim, we work with the Interim Joint Ways and Means Committee and with the Emergency Board. The process that's been in place for the last couple of biennia is that in the short interim between the long session and the short session, the Joint Ways and Means Interim Joint Ways and Means Committee has been meeting, and we staff that committee at two or three meetings during that interim. That committee does not make adjustments to the budget. So typically, if there are budgetary changes that need to be made, those kind of get saved up until we have the short session. The e-board could meet during that short interim if we needed to have them meet, but typically haven't had to have that action occur. And then in the long interim between the short session and long session, the emergency board has met. And that body can take action on budgets. So that's kind of been the structure over the last couple of biennia. And what our office does to staff items that come before those committees, typically around agency budget adjustments, they may relate to a budget note or report or a grant request. We work with the agencies to provide you a recommendation and analysis of what the agency is requesting and make recommendations on those actions for the committee. Similar to the work during session, but in the interim when those committees meet. We also publish briefs on budget-related topics and issues of interest to the legislature. If you were to go to our website, we have a publication section, and there are budget briefs on various topics related to the statewide budget. One I was thinking about earlier today as I was looking through notes for this meeting was there's one that we produced in October that really talks about how positions are managed in the statewide budget. So it talks about how they're created, how they're managed, what types of positions there are. That might be something you're interested in, especially as you hear from agencies about how they manage positions and what kind of work their employees do at this at their work level. The emergency board is similar to Joint Ways and Means, but it does have that budget authority that the Joint Ways and Means Committee doesn't have during the interim. They can make changes to the budgets, but only increase budgets or rebalance budgets. They're not able to cut budgets. So in the past, if we've been in a budget cut environment during the interim, either the governor has to put in place an allotment reduction process that trims budgets back evenly, or we have to have a special session to really adjust budgets downward or across programs. So that's how you would take care of stuff in the interim if we had a true budget crisis that couldn't be resolved during a regularly scheduled session.
Ms. Bartley, would you restate that? Because often that sometimes is misunderstood, particularly when in a budget environment like the one we have now. And going forward, some of us were here when we had several special sessions, and how that. So I just want you to restate it because you did it clear, but I think members need to hear how that occurs.
So if in the event, if this session is concluded and the budget is balanced, and then there's a revenue forecast or some issue that occurs during the interim between this long session and the short session where the budget becomes unbalanced, there's a couple of ways that can be fixed in their interim. It can't be fixed by the Interim Joint Ways and Means Committee independently because they don't adjust budgets. And it can't necessarily be fixed by the emergency board unless the fix is simply to allocate money out of the emergency fund. If there were resources there that could solve the problem and money could be allocated, they could potentially solve a problem. But if there was such a severe budget situation that the e-board could not fix it, there's a administrative rule process the governor can implement which reduces budgets across the board, suppresses spending, makes HC spend less money to save general fund, or a special session could be called in to actually take action via a legislative vehicle, via a bill to adjust agency budgets. So there's a couple ways to do that, but if the e-board cannot manage the budget through the use of the funding available to it, you're gonna have to have some other mechanism to fix things. Hopefully we won't be in that situation, Senator Winters.
Hopefully we will. I need to add something here because I think sometimes we don't appreciate our LFO staff, a lot of them have been here, and the longevity and the experience in that office and the quality that you're going to receive is excellent. You know, most of them have been here for quite a while, and they bring to us levels of experience that we need in order to carry out our work. I just need to put that on record that they, she talked about being nonpartisan, you know, bipartisan and all that, but also there is a wealth of information in LFO, both from the standpoint of budget as well as program. So I just need to add that to the record that we're very fortunate to have the caliber of staff that we do have in legislative fiscal.
So other comments or questions? The next slide just is a summary of the interim bodies I was talking about, the E-Board, what their responsibilities are, the Joint Legislative Audit Committee, the Joint Legislative Committee on Information Technology, and then the Transparency Oregon Advisory Commission. These are the formal entities and statute that the office supports during the interim. The next slide, we're starting to get into a little bit some of the technical information around the budget building process. So this slide sort of shows the Oregon budget process over a two-year period. So for you to look at the slide or the arrow that's numbered number one, so this basically starts at when an agency gets its budget. So the as I mentioned before, we're on a biennial budget building process, so the budget starts in July of an odd-numbered year, and it ends in June of the next odd-numbered year. So the biennium we're currently in ends June 30th, 2017, and the new biennium we focus on the budget for primarily will be the budget starting July 1, 2017. So once that budget is in place, agencies plan their spending. There's an allotment plan process and statute that where the agencies plan spending on a quarterly basis. They work with DASIS and then a plan. Department of Administrative Services, which is where the Chief Financial Office is located. They manage that allotment process and provide agencies the mechanisms to spend throughout the biennium. So there's an administrative process to monitor the release and spending of funds. That goes on over the course of the interim. We call budget execution is that mode. It's that spending mode. We do monitor budgets during that time frame, where agencies make sure they're not having budget issues. They implement that budget. Like I said, we monitor them. We also produce a tentative budget, so even while we're in the current biennium, we're looking ahead to kind of get a sense for what those next biennium budget impacts are going to be like. Last summer, I believe we produced a tentative budget and put it on our website in August. That was kind of a sniff test for what the 17-19 outlook was going to be like. And as I mentioned before, during the interim, agencies can come to the E-Board when it's meeting and request funds if needed or adjustments to limitations, which we'll talk in a little bit about what expenditure limitations are compared to general fund. Arrow number four. So agencies get their budget, say, in July of an even odd-numbered year. As soon as January and February of that even-numbered year, so the next year, they start building the budget for the next two-year cycle. So agencies are pretty much either in a budget building process or development process almost continuously. And that process is really pretty far in advance of reality. So what you may hear during this process, during the long session, is that agencies will say, you know, when we started building our budget, developing it a year and a half ago, things were like this, and now things have changed. So we're going to need to do something different than what we thought we were going to do going forward. You may hear some of that, especially if there's additional information about potential changes at the federal level. That may really play into how the landscape has changed since they started building their budget back in 2016 in February. So it's a very lengthy process that goes on and that is constantly evolving. So in 2016, late summer, agencies had to finalize their agency request budget. That's a budget where they come out, they work usually with stakeholders, especially the large agencies, and say, here's what we need. If we could do the things we think we need to do for our agency to do the best job it can, here's what we would do, and they lay that out. Sometimes there's constraints built into that process. The governor may say, you know, you can't ask for the sky and the moon and the stars, you can only ask for the stars, so you need to constrain yourself a little bit. This time, I think there was some pent-up demand because in the prior biennium they'd had to do that, so agencies were pretty generous might be the wrong word. We're pretty open about their needs and tried to really lay out some strategies around how to make investments that would really move programs forward. So if you hear about agency request budgets, you may hear some pretty big numbers and some pretty big ideas about how things could have been different going forward. That certainly is not what happened when we got into the governor's process. So the governor took that information and developed a budget that she presented to the legislature in early December. And that's kind of the starting point for many of the conversations in the building, although the governor has said that she's not crazy about everything that's in that product. So you're going to hear that, too, from agencies and maybe from her staff or from chief financial office staff as we move forward on trying to develop that legislative budget. So the legislature, and this is the process, number six is your process, the subcommittee process. So you're going to hear hearings on the budget, you're going to hear about the governor's budget, you're going to hear about other options, you're going to hear about things that stakeholders felt like maybe didn't get listened to or things they might recommend that would be different to kind of develop a process that's going to fit within the co-chair framework with whatever adjustments might be made to that moving forward. Then at a session, that final work product becomes the legislatively adopted budget. In terms of acronyms and terminology, we use a lot of acronyms in the budget world. You'll hear LAB a lot. It means both legislatively adopted budget and legislatively approved budget. The budget that comes out of the session that hasn't been changed is the legislatively adopted budget. And once that budget gets modified over the interim, it becomes the approved budget. So that's the differences in those in that terminology. And just if you really, really want to know about how stuff's put together, so there's a whole book that it has a bunch of instructions in it around how to build the budget. It's called the Budget Instructions. Those are released from the Chief Financial Office and provided to agencies as they start to develop their agency request budget. And many of the things in there are budget building blocks that continue on through the process. So if you want that information, I'll be happy to direct you to it, and you can delve into that. But there is a set of statewide instructions provided to agencies on how to actually go through that process. So it's not... It's controlled and it's structured and it's audited. It's not something they just get to do on their own without any oversight. So the next slide just shows what happens during the session. So arrow number one, the governor's budget became public on December 1st. If there's a new governor, that's actually a later time frame, but we didn't have a new governor, so that was available on December 1. We work with legislative leaders and co-chairs to prepare a session budget review and deliberations. So part of that process was the co-chair framework that came out in the last two or three biennial. There has been a framework that came out in advance of session. It hasn't always been that way. That can vary based on leadership and what the co-chairs want to do. Leaders and co-chairs set priorities and timelines for the session. I think the first thing that folks are involved with this time is really going out and talking to the public about the co-chair framework and trying to get a sense for where people are interested in going with that budget process. That should feed into decision points and budget adjustments at some point. We provide information to you in the process. Number four, you meet and make recommendations that get sent to the full committee for final action. And then we really, at mid to late May into June, we really start finalizing those budget decisions. So the budgets, the Human Services budget and the Oregon Health Authority budget will probably be some of the last budgets that get out of committee. Again, the big budgets are usually further along in the process and really require some of that final decision making to occur. And one of the drivers around that decision making is the revenue forecast. So the statewide general fund revenue forecast that will occur, the May forecast comes out or is released the 16th of May. That's a Tuesday. So that will really be the funding level that will help determine the final budget number. So really until that number is out there, it makes it pretty challenging to finalize the budget. So that's a kind of a date to have out there. And I think, Representative Buehler, are you on the Revenue Committee? Mm-hmm. So you're part of that process. So we do, as mentioned previously, there is some overlap between the Revenue Committee and some of the policy committees in the subcommittee, which I think will be helpful for some of the statewide context as well as some of the policy issues that may come up before the Budget Committee. There is a February forecast that comes out the 22nd of February, so that may be another interim sort of checkpoint that we'll use to help drive some budget conversations over the course of the session as well. Any questions on process at this point? The next slide. So this is really talking about sort of the budget component. So in terms of funding, I've talked about general fund a little bit, so that's statewide general fund revenue, tax dollars, and other monies that go into that general fund. There's also lottery money, which is the money that comes from the lottery games and programs, other funds, and federal funds. So general fund is fungible. It's state resources that can be applied anywhere in the budget. So it's easy to allocate. There's no strings around it. You can use it to budget or buy anything across the whole statewide budget, which is why the focus in the co-chair budget is really around that general fund resource, because that's really the flexible, fungible resource out there that's available to state government. Lottery funds is dedicated to economic development, education, parks, salmon habitat, and some veterans programs. So lottery funds is a little bit more targeted at where it can go and a little bit less flexible, although there is some flexibility within some of the overarching programs. The other funds and federal funds are dedicated by law for specific purposes. Some example of, and other funds are usually really linked to a specific program in an agency. And some examples of those types of dollars are fees for licenses and registrations, for example, hunting and fishing license revenues, occupational license revenues, loan programs, and payments for services. In human services, some of the other funds resources, here I'll just add a layer of complication. So and sometimes in an agency, an other funds resource may not really be a fee-related resource and may be a federal funds resource from another agency. So, for example, in the Department of Human Services, there's a program called Employment-Related Daycare. It provides daycare assistance to people who are lower income levels and trying to really get a foothold in the workforce. The funding for that program comes from federal Child Care Development Fund dollars primarily, although we put in some general fund as well. Those monies flow to the Department of Education Early Learning Division. They come to that agency as federal money. Then Early Learning Division sends the money to Department of Human Services, and when they come to DHS, they become other funds. So sometimes this funding trail is a little bit complicated, but we'll point that out when we get to places in the budget that are like that. You might hear us talk about this being the color of the money. And when we say color of the money, we mean which one of these things are we talking about?
Another good example of other funds that start out as other fund types is like PEB, the Public Benefits Board for that provides health care for state employees. Their budget is other funds, but it originates in each agency's budget as general fund, other funds, federal funds, lottery funds. Depending on how that specific position gets paid in that agency. But then when the money is passed over to PEB to pay for the health care bill, it becomes other funds. So even though it's other funds and it's dedicated, it in essence has an indirect general fund component. So if you save on the PEB bill, you'll save some general fund.
And I will say personally that this was perhaps the most confusing thing to me when I started to read budgets in depth, because figuring out what those other funds really are and realizing that we do, in essence, double count a lot of the money in our budget. For example, the Department of Administrative Services runs largely on assessment. We do not give it general fund money directly. That's the agency that runs the fleet and the phones and most of our IT and all that kind of stuff. We don't give it money directly. What it does is it charges assessments to different agencies, sometimes on an FTE basis, sometimes on other bases, and that money comes to them, and that money as other funds, and that money could be general fund or federal fund or fee or lottery funds or you name it. So other funds is perhaps the most confusing part, personally, I think personally, and it's hard to figure out what's the best way to account for it. But be aware that a lot of money in the budget gets double counted.
In this particular program area, there's also a lot of federal money that comes to both the Oregon Health Authority and the Department of Human Services. One area where there's a pretty good chunk of funding that comes through is in the Medicaid arena. So one thing you may hear us talk about is something called the Federal Medical Assistance Percentage, which is abbreviated FMAP, and that is the federal participation amount, the percentage of federal money that comes in to match up with state dollars to fund programs. So that's a percentage that will go up and down. Right now, Oregon's percentage that's coming from the feds is going down because Oregon's per capita income is higher and it's been doing well economically. So this is a nationwide formula that's put in place by the federal government. And depending on how states are doing economically, if they're doing poorly economically, they get a higher federal percentage. And if things improve, they get a lower percentage. So we had been getting higher percentages for, I think, since 2014 because we hadn't been doing very well economically. And now the pendulum's shifting. So one thing you'll hear us talk about when we talk about budgetary needs going forward is that in both of the large agencies, there's a dependence on this revenue stream that's shifting that either if we can't find general fund to backfill that shift, we're going to have to do something with programs. So that's something you'll hear a lot in this particular program area. There's also federal money that comes in for the Supplemental Nutritional Assistance Program, or SNAP, or food stamps. We get federal dollars for that program. There's federal money that comes in for the temporary assistance for needy families. We've got federal funds that come in to help with foster care and adoption assistance. So there's a lot of federal funding, federal resources that come into the department. Now, these other and federal funds, the way that we budget them is through what's called an expenditure limitation. So that revenue comes to the department, but we put a limitation on the spending to control what they spend in terms of those dollars. So we may, when you hear an adjustment to expenditure limitation, it's talking about adjusting the spending level for those programs. What we would hear for general fund is an appropriation of general fund. That's a direct general fund appropriation to the agency. And lottery funds are allocated to the agency. Those are just differences in terminology about how those funds are described. Other funds and federal funds can also be either limited, which is mostly what they are limited. There are some areas where they're non-limited. For example, in the Supplemental Nutritional Assistance Program, that benefit that goes directly to people who are eligible for food stamps is non-limited because it fluctuates. It's direct federal dollars to those clients or those individuals. We don't cap how that benefit works. It gets to ebb and flow. There's some other areas in the budget. I think there's some maybe benefit payments in, I think, public employee retirement system are non-limited as well. So there's some, but they're very limited. We don't have very many of those non-limited categories anymore. We've tried to constrain those. And with annual sessions, it really feels like there really isn't a reason that you would need to have that much non-limited stuff out there, because you have the ability to adjust budgets, you know, routinely and on a schedule that you know is going to happen. So, as Senator Sanger Hayward said, it's
gone. Sorry, Representative Buehler.
Yeah, thanks. Sorry to interrupt, but what happens to unrestricted retained assets at the end of the budget cycle?
When you say an asset, you mean revenue?
Dollars that aren't spent, basically.
So, if it's an other fund dollar, so if it's other funds that belong to the agency, it will be sitting in an account, and if we've, and typically, what, we won't have a lot of this in this subcommittee because we don't have a lot of other funded agencies. But normally, another funded agency that say it's funded by fees or some kind of revenue stream, they will need to retain some of that for cash flow purposes and to carry forward the next biennium. So they'll have a balance in that fund that stays there and carries forward and then gets adjusted. Then they get to spend that limited amount out of it over the next biennium. Mm-hmm. Sometimes in the past, if there is excessive balances of monies in those accounts, they have been repurposed to the extent which they can be under law for other governmental purposes. So that can happen. But sometimes it depends on the nature of what's in that fund balance and whether or not it's a constitutional account or what kind of legal limits are on it. Do you have a specific thing in mind you're thinking about?
No, where do we get visibility with regards to the amount that's retained?
In the budget document, you'll find it in an ending balance. So it will show up in a budget display as being what's left over.
The ending balance for the agency?
Mm-hmm. By agency.
By agency.
Yeah, and some of the financial statements, I haven't looked at them lately, but I do believe you might be able to get a sense for it at the statewide level and some of the accounting statements where those are. But again, sometimes accounting world is very different from budget world. Mm-hmm. One thing I wanted to point out is people often ask us for the statewide budget document. Mm-hmm. There's not really a statewide budget document. We have a lot of pieces that go together, and we have a lot of summary documents. But as far as one big report that shows spending by all the categories statewide, and then down here there's an ending balance, mm-hmm. there's not really a document like that exists.
You tend to see them a little bit more in fee-based agencies. Mm-hmm. So the licensure boards, when we have the Oregon Medical Board and the Board of Nursing in here, because their licensure fees only come in once a year or once even every 2 years, they carry big ending fund balances mm-hmm. over, and we expect that because they have to keep operating. Even when they, you know, they basically get an infusion of cash once every 2 years, and then they have to keep operating, or once a year, and they keep operating.
We also ask agencies for ending fund balance reports, and we just did that recently. We pretty much know which agencies really rely heavily on those other funds and who typically has a balance. We ask for a series of reports to give us an update on where they think their projected ending fund balance is going to be at the end of the current biennium, which helps us inform what we may or may not be able to do in 17-19. And sometimes, especially in agencies where they're using a mix of resources, so maybe they're using some general fund for programs and some other fund resources, if it looks like they've got more than adequate other funds on the table, sometimes we will take away some of those general fund resources, at least on a short-term basis, to and take advantage of those other resources so we can save on general
fund. Can you share that report with me?
There's not one big report. Do you have a particular agency you want to look at?
DHS and OHA.
Sure.
So and I think the one thing to note is that general fund always reverts back at the end. So you don't have these ending fund balances of general fund because that reverts back to the general fund at the end of the biennium. So that's one thing to keep in mind. We're specifically talking about other funds. Mm-hmm. The other thing to kind of point out that the senator talked about, and if you're depending on the agency, sometimes you do inflationary increases. And when you do the inflationary increases, you're going to take in a surplus during the first couple of years. Mm-hmm. And then you'll dip down below, and so you kind of manage that cash flow over a period of time, knowing that inflation is going to occur. And so there is, you know, for instance, in a lot of the natural resources side, you'll take in a little bit more in the beginning years, and then it kind of flexes down. So it's really a long-term cash flow management on the other funds. So that's something to think about when you're looking at those things. And each agency is a little different, right? And you just chat with them.
But, Senator Winters.
But also, and it's looking at particularly other fund agencies and making certain that they don't deplete a balance. Mm-hmm. You know, there is, whether it's a 3-month that you allow them to have a balance, mm-hmm. it's just like a business to make certain they're not depleting their cash flow. It will vary among agencies. And the other thing, and I think, and that's why I said you need to do your homework, Co-Chair Rayfield's correct about a general fund, they do go back. But also remember that those agencies not only have generally a little bit of other fund, but they've got their federal funds and what happens there, as well as what's happening with the general fund dollars. So, and I'm sure that Ms. Byerly can help you on all three fronts.
I think one of the challenges that I've struggled with around ending fund balances has been because we always have general fund revert back, we have occasionally seen people scrambling to spend them if they have them. Now, that's not true generally in the agencies that we have in this subcommittee because they're big and they rarely run general fund surpluses at the end of the biennium. In fact, we're usually trying to find more money for them, not because they overspend, but because caseloads change or things change or inflation. But in the long term, one of the things the state may need to think about is how do we think about ending fund balances and how do we encourage agencies to look for ways to save money? Because right now, frankly, they're not necessarily incentivized to do that because they can't hang on to those general fund ending balances. Now, we don't want them skimping on services we're asking them to provide, but conversely, we don't want them being profligate. So it's a fine balance that we face on an ongoing basis.
Is it not, would we do a rebalance every, 6 months? Or
with OHA and DHS?
Yes.
Pretty much.
We've typically been doing it in the short, we did one in the short session, and we're planning on doing one probably in May when we did do one. So
we did one in December.
So part of that is also to help.
We did it partially. We didn't really fix it.
No. We did a partial rebalance.
So part of that is to also help with two things. One, in caseload adjustments, as well as how that impacts budget. And so in order to keep on top of the budgets for human service for DHS. And without that, you know, if we had to wait every year in order to do those rebalances, we could end up with all kind of chaos. But because we do actually look at both caseload adjustments, look at where we are budgetarily, it allows us to make adjustments inside of those that we wouldn't be able to do otherwise.
Representative Hayden.
Thank you, Chair. I'm curious about the rebalancing process. I know we're talking about it, and a lot of you are very experienced with that, so you can just kind of mention a sentence here or there. But what is that process? And I'm hearing we do it every couple of years. We do it every 6 months for agencies. Can you kind of give a more broad, simplified, what the rebalance process is? How often do we do it? And what are the, where, when the funds revert back to the general fund, what happens with, I understand there's rebalancing bills and people say, well, I could use that money. How does that process work?
So let me talk. So one thing you're hearing in this conversation is a very specific rebalance terminology related to Oregon Health Authority and the Department of Human Services. Traditionally, those have been, it all used to be one big agency at one time, right? When was that? When did they split?
2009. So after 2009.
A million years ago, it was a whole bunch of small agencies that all came together and then split back out. So in this big human services client mix, there's a lot of sharing of clients. There's a lot of commonality in programs. So traditionally, over time, a rebalance was really talking about as caseloads evolve and people move in and out, we want to be able to manage this overall budget and be able to make sure we're using the money the best way we can. So the rebalance in that context is really about, over here in aging people with disabilities, they're underspending their general fund. And over here in intellectual development disabilities, we've got a problem. So let's move some of that money around and keep those programs balanced and keep it so that we don't have to go ask for general fund from the E fund or cut a program. So that's really the rebalance we're talking about specific to these two big agencies is sort of that process. Is that accurate, Linda? That's kind of been specific to those agencies. And it's not always about general funds. Sometimes new resources come in. There may be extra federal funds that comes in and you can apply that to a program. Then, so that's what we're talking specific to caseload. We look at caseload every 6 months. As that fluctuates, we might want to tweak the budget. That's one part. Now, the statewide rebalance, what you may hear is we did a statewide rebalance bill in the February session, which had a bunch of budget adjustments in it. I think it had, you remember what kind of statewide changes were in there?
It distributed the compensation package, for one thing.
Okay. The salary pot was distributed in that bill. So that was a statewide bill. And in some, back to what other states do, some states have just one big, huge budget bill. They have a big, huge omnibus budget bill for, like, all their programs, right? Oregon doesn't use that model. We use an agency has a budget bill, and we put their budget in that specific bill, and it follows the agency. But we do have omnibus rebalance bills for various purposes. So in February, there was a rebalance. And so when you say, so there's a new revenue forecast, there's money in the E fund, there might be money on the table, and that gets back to your comment about, well, yeah, I can spend this, I can spend that. That rebalance wasn't so much about taking money away from agencies and redistributing it. It was more about, I think there were more resources on the table, or there may have been some resources freed up because other revenues were available. So that's kind of a statewide picture. Does that help? Or?
Yeah.
And so I think what you'll see this session is I think there will be another one of those for the current biennium. So for 2015-17, which isn't done yet, I think we'll have another mini rebalance bill early in session that will fix some stuff statewide potentially. It won't touch every agency. It'll be a handful of agencies. They may need some limitation. They might need to move some money around.
And that deals with funds up until June 30th,
yes.
Right?
So we're still actively in a current biennium that may need to be adjusted. So there'll be a bill that would adjust that current biennium. So there's probably going to be one early in session that will deal with statewide stuff, and then we expect we'll need a second bill in May to do just OHA and DHS. The reason we can't do that earlier is because we want to have that spring forecast number to be able to build into any calculations. We want to have it later. It's a little early for that.
And the forecast being the caseload forecast in this case.
So we've got a whole bunch of agency budget bills, one for each agency, right? And committees will be taking action on that. So this subcommittee, other subcommittees, will be moving those budget bills out of subcommittee to full committee throughout the session. What that doesn't account for, potentially, are other statewide type adjustments. So we'll have a bill. At the very end of session, there'll be the Christmas tree bill or the omnibus bill. You'll hear those terms. And that will probably include an array of statewide adjustments, potentially for the Department of Administrative Services and the Department of Justice.
Yes.
So as Senator Steinmeier Hayward mentioned, those are agencies that are funded by all the other agencies. They all send money to them. And once those budgets are finalized, especially in a budget reduction environment, there'll be pressure to pull those budgets down, which means the money that was built in all these agencies isn't needed as much anymore. So we'll have some statewide adjustments that pull budgets down that, again, put dollars on the table. So there'll be that, and then sometimes that bill has included, if that May forecast came in really good and there was extra money, That's the Christmas tree component where people, hey, I've got my short list of all the really cool things I want to do. Can I have part of that money?
Great.
So you'll see that, but that's usually last end of session bill, really late action that really is the final act to balance the budget. So one thing that can be confusing, if you're to go back and try to say, what is this agency's budget for 17-19? It's going to have that early budget bill component, and then it'll probably have another component in a later bill that will need to be put together to really get the full picture. And that's something we do in that analysis we produce after session. That includes all actions on the agency's budget, even ones that are impacted potentially by policy bills that may have funding in them. So we look at the holistic budget amount after session. All session actions are completed.
That's usually tweaked by the e-board, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes, and so once that budget is set after session, the e-board can adjust it if the e-board's meeting. It could be changed in that short session because we know we have a February session that'll be out there. It could be adjusted there then.
Mm-hmm.
The interim Joint Ways and Means Committee doesn't have the ability to change the budget, so it has to be the e-board or the session committee during session, or potentially you could have action during a special session if that was called.
And so one limitation on the power of the emergency board is they cannot reduce budgets,
right?
Which is kind of interesting. We do have a tool called unscheduling. We can ask the Department of Administrative Services to set the system up so they can't spend something, but we can't actually pull
take
money
it away
until we're into session.
And Sarah Gilf, I know you have a question. I just want to say one quick thing that I think is useful for new members that I finally realized this year. Ms. Byerly pointed out that every agency has its own budget bill. Mm-hmm. That means just like any policy bill, any materials associated with that, any agency presentation, any answers to questions that the committee asks, any LFO documentation will be associated with that bill number. So, for example, I don't know what the bill number is for OHA is this year. Do you know?
5026, House Bill.
Right. This year it's 5026, and it's easy to remember. Last time, 2 years ago, it was 5526, and they just switched back and forth.
All budget bills that start in the House are 50, all the Senate bills are 5, right? So 5026, if you want anything that comes up about the health authority, that we've seen about the health authority anytime, you just look for that bill number, and it's going to be just like any policy bill, and you can find it. You do not have to do what I have historically done, which is try to remember which day we heard it on and gone back and plowed through.
Just go 5026.
Yeah, I know. That's what I'm saying. Senator Gelser.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a clarification on the rebalance process. Huh? Before we reconfigured and broke apart the health authority and DHS, and they were all one big thing, it seemed like money in a rebalance could be moved across Oregon Health Authority and what's now DHS. With that reorganization, is there kind of a firewall within that reorganization? OHA money can only be rebalanced within OHA, and DHS money can only be rebalanced within DHS, so that if there's a surplus, which wouldn't that be great in OHA, we couldn't use that to address caseload in DHS?
If we balance in session with a bill, we can do that.
Okay.
Because in a bill, we can take money away from OHA and give it to DHS. We can't do that at the e-board.
Okay.
So the e-board can't take money away from OHA and give it to DHS. So when we do a bill during session, though, we can adjust that if we can move money back and forth.
But follow up, please. Before the reorganization, was the e-board able to move across that broader chunk?
Well, it was all one agency.
Right. Okay.
So we traditionally, again, and I wasn't involved with the budget then, but when it was under one agency umbrella, it was all within the same agency. Okay. So we did more of that.
Okay.
So now they're separate, distinct entities. One more thing I wanted to just mention on federal funds. So again, federal money comes into both the big agencies in this program area. You probably are aware of this, but the federal fiscal year is different than our state fiscal year, right? So the current federal fiscal year is federal fiscal year 17. It ends in September. Our fiscal year runs July to July. So there's this kind of overlap dynamic, plus the federal government likes to take a really long time to finalize stuff. So I would say in the arena of federal money, we're constantly estimating. And so we're always kind of estimating what's going to happen. It's really hard to pin it down precisely. So just keep that in mind as talking about federal funds, that we're constantly trying to figure out where it's going to land. We don't always know till really late in the process.
And I would say that that is particularly true this year. And so these two budgets, OHA and DHS, are often some of the last ones to go forward. That's probably going to be particularly true this year because there's so much uncertainty. And I frankly expect that we'll have to do some major work on them in 2018, if not before, based on whatever happens at the federal level, because there's so much uncertainty there right now with the new administration.
One other thing, while we're still on this slide, we're talking a little bit about general fund reverting to the reverting at the end of the biennium. That is something that is looked at as part of planning ahead, what we think those reversions might be like. That will go into a beginning balance for 17-19, so that is something that's examined as budgets are finalized. And that real number will show up eventually in a revenue forecast and be available for potential resource use in the short session.
Ms. Bradley, we've got about 2 more minutes for today.
2 more minutes?
2 more minutes. I told my committee to show up on time, and we're going to get them out.
How many slides have I gone through? 7?
I'm sorry, but it's good questions, I think, from the committee.
Yeah, so this next page is an example of a work session report. So just to kind of, okay, where does some of this junk show up? So as Linda mentioned, you're going to see there's going to be a ton of material. All the pages and pages of reports from DHS and OHA, they'll be available to you in OLIS. This is the kind of document, though, that you actually, LFO will bring in to committee and present to you when we take action on a budget. So it's a display. This is a small agency in the subcommittee. It's from last long session, long-term care ombudsman. Here's where you're going to see general fund, lottery fund, other funds, federal funds. So you're going to see the funding sources across the top of that report. You're going to see total funds, which is everything added together, the number of positions, the number of full-time equivalent positions, and then down the left side, you're going to see some of the budget elements, you know, the budget that was adopted, how it got adjusted, the approved budget, and then some of the budget building components. This is just to give you a sense for what some of the information will look like that you might see come before the committee. We haven't gone through what some of these base budget package building elements are, but this is where you'll see it. You'll see all these funds show up, and then you'll see a total funds, which will be the overall budget for the agency. The next slide, budget process detail. So some of those components in the expenditure, so when we talk about expenditures, are broken out into certain categories: personal services, personnel costs, wages, PERS, benefits, Social Security, positions, and FTE. That's what's in that bucket. Services and supplies includes operational costs, travel, office supplies, rent, legal expenses, contracts. Special payments include revenue transfers and other payments. In this program area, special payments are huge. In both Oregon Health Authority and in DHS, a significant amount of that budget goes out in special payments, both directly to individuals and to providers that provide direct services to clients. So we'll get into those slides, but you're going to see a big chunk of that budget is in special payments. Capital outlay includes certain purchases that have a value of more than $5,000 and a longer life of certain years. They're capitalizable, I guess, is that the term? And then capital improvement are some other types of instruction projects with cost less than $1 million, and major construction acquisition includes construction remodel improvements of costs that are greater than $1 million. Debt service, you'll see debt service in both of the large agency budgets. That's related to principal and interest payments on bonds that were sold for prior activities or construction in those agencies.
Quick question for you.
Yeah.
Could you just provide a key term definitions for, you know, adjusted current service level.
Back on that slide.
Base budget versus so, legislative approved.
In this display.
Budget. Start there tomorrow.
In this display.
Could we start there tomorrow, okay. Representative, if we could, just so we're sure that we've got that. In fact, maybe what I could request is if the committee has that term or other terms that have not been clear, if you could shoot Ms. Byerly and Ms. Ames a quick email and they could provide an additional supplemental document for the committee, if I could make that request of both committee members and staff.
And it is in our slides. Not quite at this technical level, but in general,
give you a crosswalk piece that. Because you'll see this again. This will come up in work session reports for all budgets.
Okay. Any final business for today? If not, we are adjourned. See you at 8:30. See you at 8:30. Business for today? If not, we are adjourned.